Welcome to the Sutliffian Report. Today is Thanksgiving 2021, and boy, do we have a lot to be thankful for. And today I am going to share with you a history of Thanksgiving, and I am going to share with you an allegory. A friend of mine, Cal Fritzy, narrated this allegory back in, it's a few years ago, and shortly thereafter, after I put this up, she passed away. It was a shock to me, but she is fondly remembered. You may know her as Cal the Red Fox. Her work in this area is well renowned, and she's just someone to be respected. Now, I want to start out with a reading from God's words about Thanksgiving. This comes from 2 Chronicles chapter 16, verses 7 to 34. So I'm just going to read. Then on that day, David delivered first this psalm to thank the Lord into the hand of Asaph and his brethren. Give thanks unto the Lord. Call upon his name. Make known his deeds among the people. Sing unto him. Sing psalms unto him. Talk you of all his wondrous works. Glory you in his holy name. Let the heart of them rejoice that seek the Lord. Seek the Lord and his strength. Seek his face continually. Remember his marvelous works that he has done, his wonders and his judgments of his mouth. O you seed of Israel, his servant, you children of Jacob, his chosen ones. He is the Lord our God. His judgments are in all the earth. Be mindful always of his covenant, the word which he commanded to a thousand generations, even of the covenant which he made with Abraham and of his oath unto Isaac, and has confirmed the same to Jacob for a law and to Israel for an everlasting covenant, saying, unto you will I give the land of Canaan, the lot of your inheritance, when you were but few, even a few, and strangers in it, and when they went from nation to nation and from one kingdom to another people. He suffered no man to do them wrong. Yea, he reproved kings for their sakes, saying, touch not my anointed, and do my prophets no harm. Sing unto the Lord all the earth. Show forth from day to day his salvation. Declare his glory among the heathen, his marvelous works among all nations. For great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised. He also is to be feared above all gods, for all the gods of the people are idols. But the Lord made the heavens. Glory and honor are in his presence. Strength and gladness are in his place. Give unto the Lord, you kindreds of the people. Give unto the Lord glory and strength. Give unto the Lord the glory due unto his name. Bring an offering and come before him. Worship the Lord in the beauty of his holiness. Fear before him all the earth. The world also shall be stable, that it be not moved. Let the heavens be glad, and let the earth rejoice, and let men say among the nations, the Lord reigns. Let the sea roar and the fullness thereof. Let the fields rejoice and all that is therein. Then shall the trees of the woods sing out at the presence of the Lord, because he comes to judge the earth. Oh, give thanks unto the Lord, for he is good, for his mercy endures forever. And say you, save us, O God of our salvation, and gather us together, and deliver us from the heathen, that we may give thanks to your holy name and glory in your praise. Wow. What am I thankful for? I have three beautiful children. I'm thankful for each one of them. They are a light to me. I have two that won't talk to me, yet I am so thankful for them. I keep up on what they're doing. as much as I can. I know all I can say is that God loves them and I love them and I smile when I think of them. I have a great family and much of my family is my church brethren. And my friends here on Blog Talk Radio and in other forums who work together to get the truth out. That to me is so much because we work together and support each other and help each other be better at what we do. For them, I am thankful and I thank God for them. So I have a lot to be thankful for. Now I'm going to be sharing with you the history of Thanksgiving. And let me tell you why I think that's important. First of all, why it's personal for me. Here's the thing that may surprise you. Thanksgiving for me, this is going to get interesting for you probably. Thanksgiving for me is historical for my family. My family came on the second Mayflower. They may have been here shortly before or shortly after, I haven't figured out which, that first Thanksgiving. My family came as on that second Mayflower, and they were known as the men of, they were part of the men of Kent. And they settled in the area known as Scituate, Massachusetts. So Thanksgiving has historical meaning for me and my family. Probably more so me, because I'm the guy who gets into history. So without further ado, I'm going to start this in Blog Talk Radio and then get it started. Well, I'll start it here first.
In North America, you'll notice the leaves are changing color. Pumpkin spice lattes are back, and Charlie Brown is playing on TV. That must mean it's time for Thanksgiving, with family, friends, and loads of turkey. Even if you're not an American, you've probably heard of the holiday, but the image of pacifist settlers singing Kumbaya alongside the natives is all wrong. The story begins on a cold pier in England in August of 1620, when 120 men, women, and children stepped onto two English merchant ships in Southampton Harbor bound for the Americas. Both vessels seemed to be held together by spit and prayers. The Speedwell was so old, it had fought against the Spanish Armada in 1588, and the Mayflower was such an ungainly transport ship that it could barely sail into the wind. And since the North Atlantic in the fall and winter is nothing but westerly winds, it was the absolute worst ship to try and attempt a crossing with. But somehow, the Mayflower had made it to the Americas twice before, even if it had taken twice as long as normal. Luckily, these would-be colonists were determined. They had to be. They were Brownists, religious dissenters from the Anglican Church of England. You see, the Brownist beliefs were relatively simple. The first, that only the word of the Holy Bible was infallible. The second, that individual churches and their local communities should have more say and autonomy in the goings-on of the church. Both these beliefs were aimed at jettisoning the corrupt power structure of the old Catholicism. That didn't happen. As the new church started looking more Catholic by the day, the Brownists bought themselves a printing press and began passing out leaflets that opposed it, which led to the Brownists becoming intimately familiar with the inside of London's prison system. They got such a bad rap that Shakespeare even mentions them in one of his plays, Twelfth Night, where he says, "I had as gladly be a Brownist as a politician." Not exactly a flattering comparison. So the Pilgrims decided to risk it all as a startup colony in the Americas, creaky boat and all. It would be an English colony, but one not bound by religious politics. So they set sail and braved the rough fall seas in August of 1620. They hadn't even made it out of the port, though, before they found that the Speedwell was taking on water, so they pulled over in Dartmouth for repairs. Undaunted, they shored the leaking boards and set out again, to a new life, and watched with glee as Land's End and Cornwall slipped away behind them. Only to turn around and immediately see it again. The Speedwell had recently been refitted with a larger mast, and somebody had clearly botched the job. the ship was going nowhere. So 20 people agreed to stay behind and bring more of their congregation with them the next year, and 102 crammed onto the already overloaded Mayflower, finally leaving again on the 6th of September. Or maybe it was the 16th. No one's actually sure. The calendars in that period are a bit wonky. Their trip was mercifully dull after recent events. But halfway across the ocean, the pilgrims' good luck set back in again. A storm and strong winds hit. In the middle of the storm, a deep snap echoed through the ship. A main beam had cracked. So they pulled a spare from the hold and tried to reinforce it. But the buckling was so severe that it wouldn't stay in place. That meant it was time to turn around and go back to England. Again. The delays had already exhausted all the pilgrims' money, and for them, that wasn't an option. So they decided to try something else first. They had brought a great iron screw with them as cargo, likely a piece of the exact printing press that had gotten them kicked out of England in the first place, and used that to raise the new beam into place. Somehow, it held long enough to get them across the Atlantic. They sighted land on 9th November, just off Cape Cod, then turned south for the Hudson River Valley, hoping to move closer to established colonies and warm weather. But hard winter currents forced them back to Massachusetts, where they set up anchor in the natural harbor of Provincetown. Knowing that their previous claim on this new land had been dodgy at best, the settlers agreed to draw up a new contract for their colony, styling it the Mayflower Compact. It organized them as a civil body politic, created for the general good of the colony, where issues would be decided by vote. This set of rules and beliefs set down by the pilgrims has since been called the world's first written constitution. The men of the ship put their names to paper, and they all signed the agreement together. And within weeks, they would all begin dying together. Scurvy and illness took hold of the boat, and as the first snows arrived, it turned the ship into an icy tomb. Exploration parties were sent out to find a suitable place to build, and any man who could still stand was put aboard with swords, armor, and matchlocks. They found a deserted landscape and found themselves strangers in an unknown land, filled with native burials and abandoned villages. But everywhere they went, eyes watched them. Going as far as they could each day, they camped on the shores, and in the dim morning, they draped their jackets over a barricade to dry and made to move their boats back into the water. And that's when the arrows began to rain down on them. Grabbing muskets, they fired blindly into the forest. Their leader appeared from behind a tree and fired three arrows directly at the pilgrims. The man gave a triumphant cry and then disappeared again into the forest. The pilgrims searched the area but found no bodies, only 18 arrows tipped with deer horn, brass, and eagle's claws. When they went to retrieve their jackets, they found them riddled with arrow holes. Guessing that as many as 30 or 40 men waited for them in the forest, the pilgrims left before they could return. The next day, they found the building place they were looking for, well suited to winter construction, already cleared of timber, with tall hills for defensive positions. But it was also full of dead bodies. Pawtuxet had been a village of the Wampanoag people, until it had been wiped out by an outbreak of Indian fever 3 years earlier. The epidemic was bad enough that the colonists found unburied skeletons still inside their homes. But with more settlers dying by the second, the pilgrims were in no shape to be picky. They moved the Mayflower to join them and began construction. The first common house that was finished became a hospital for the ill, and the 19 families then each built their own town, huddled together for defense. And by February, the settlement was complete. But without food or proper shelter, they continued to die off one by one by one. And by the time the snows thawed, only 47 of the original 102 pilgrims were still alive, and half of the Mayflower crew had died as well. Those that survived now faced the danger of summer raiding parties, so they decided to fortify the village, bringing cannons from the ship to point outwards into the unknown wilds. Finally free of the bitter cold, they planted corn taken from the abandoned graves and storehouses of the old Wampanoag village. And with that first thaw came their first contact with the locals. A man, tall and dark-skinned, boldly strode out of the forest and made to walk directly into the center of their town. The pilgrims stopped him, guns pointed. Then he opened his mouth and greeted them in English, welcoming them to the new land and then promptly asked for a beer to drink. He was Samoset of the Eastern Abenaki, who'd spent years trading tales and supplies with English fishermen who passed through the area. And as he swapped stories over his acquired taste for English delicacies, he warned that not every tribe would be as friendly as his. But they could get little more out of him, as his English was broken at best. The next week, Samoset returned with a new man, Tisquantum, known today as Squanto, who spoke fluent English. He was the last survivor of the Patuxet tribe, the very land the pilgrims now inhabited, who had been taken by slavers as a boy and had lived in Spain and England before escaping back home again, only to find his own people had been wiped out by disease. He had been taken captive, a useful tool to deal with the continuing English encroachment. Squanto heralded the arrival of 60 armed warriors and their chief, the Wampanoag. The pilgrims grabbed their muskets and ran to the walls and waited for the worst. But neither side wanted to make the first move. With a bit of back and forth from Squanto, their chief, Massasoit, agreed to sit down with the pilgrims' governor, and after a healthy amount of liquor to loosen up both sides, they set about with the business of peace. See, the Wampanoag found themselves beset on all sides by enemy tribes, with plenty of land, but no power to hold them back. Where others saw the English settlers as a threat, Massasoit saw an opportunity. The pilgrims agreed to help the chief against his enemies by using their muskets and cannons, in return for mutual protection, and some much-needed agricultural advice from Squanto, specifically how to plant the native foods that the pilgrims had never before encountered. And so began an unlikely friendship, where Squanto passed on his knowledge of the land. Under his tutelage, the pilgrims learned how to plant corn, bean, and squash in a way that ensured that each would thrive. When they weren't planting, they sent diplomatic parties out to every tribe in a 50-mile radius to agree to mutual peace, and took time to knock the heads of anyone who threatened their native allies. So by the time the fall came and the harvest ready to be brought in, they found themselves looking quite optimistically to the new year, especially in comparison to the last. It was in this spirit that the men were sent into the forest to shoot a few game birds, likely turkeys and waterfowl, for a feast to give thanks to the Lord for their bounty and good luck. Massasoit joined them with 90 of his people and brought along 5 deer for the occasion. Add to that a few eels, some fish, crabs, and a lobster or two, and of course their freshly harvested corns, beans, and squash, and you got yourself the first Thanksgiving dinner. It was a celebration that lasted for 3 days, a harvest festival with sport, games, and friends, like so many others around the world. Days of Thanksgiving, thankful that there will be enough food to eat, and another year survived. Sure, the new land wasn't perfect. It wasn't harmony between man and beast, or a permanent peace between settler and native. But for a time, people set aside their differences and gave their thanks for a chance at life. And many other harvest festivals appear around the world today for just the same thing. And that's the story of the first Thanksgiving.
So this is the history of Thanksgiving, and like I said, it's personal to me because my family came on the second Mayflower, which means they came about 1623. It was I think the year after, because they're talking about the second year, which would be 1621, 1622 that they survived. So my family came shortly thereafter, and look where we are now. My family spread all across the United States. Now, I have something special for us tonight, because I didn't want to go into a lot of what's happening today, because it's a day to give thanks. So I decided to share the work of Cal Fritzi, her work reading Matthew, I can never say his name right, let me get that right, Matthew Bracken's Alien Orc Way. Now, Matthew Bracken, this piece is something, my recommendation is that you come back to this, you play this over and over again, you play it for your children. In fact, it is recorded separately. You can find that separately on my channel. Just listen to this. This story will shock you. It's well done. It's well done. Thank you for saying that. Yes, we did separate ourselves from evil. That was the joy that we separated from in the 1700s. We fought, at least my family fought. The members of my family chose not to fight. They ran off to Canada to hide because the rest of the family were going after them. But this is about reasons to give thanks. So I do want to share the alien orc way. And without further ado, I'm just going to play that.
My name is Neku. This is the story of my people who live on the great island of Plenty.
And here we go.
Our island is so vast, and the need for travel so small, and it being very difficult to cross the high mountain ridges, people most often live near where they are born. Food is easy to grow or to pick everywhere and at all times of the year. Plenty of fish to catch as well. But from time to time, a traveler might visit, sometimes by boat, and sometimes by climbing over the sharp-topped mountains between the numberless valleys. As you may suppose, because of the difficulty of distant traveling, news from afar does not travel quickly on the island of Plenty. But I did hear a few years earlier about some new people from the outside, people who had landed on the other side of our island. We call Far Plenty. These new people were said to be very strange and not so pleasant. They did some unusual praying at night, possibly to the moon. They were called the Alanok people, that they had come from a very terrible island, an island full of war and hunger, and that they needed to find a new home where they could live in peace. Now, on the island of Plenty, we have two very important rules or laws that we must always obey. The first law of Plenty is that anybody can believe anything that they want to believe or not believe anything they don't want to believe. And that is okay, because all ideas are equal on the island of Plenty. The second law of Plenty is that if you give kindness and plenty to other people, they should always give kindness and plenty to you in return. After all, it is the island of plenty, and the bounty should be shared. Why not? There is plenty for all. These laws came from our distant ancestors who once suffered wars and hunger until they learned the two laws. Then the island of plenty also became the island of peace and contentment. So, it is understandable that when the Alanok people escaped from a terrible place and first be warmly welcomed, the Alanoks had severe needs, and the people of Far Plenty possessed a great bounty to share with them. But according to the rare visitors to our valleys, the Alanoks were rather strange and unpleasant, and did something odd at night when the moon had risen. That was all I knew about them. Came when a man about my age, with a very weak and sickly wife and a young daughter, climbed down the steep cliffs and crawled into our village, almost to the point of perishing. His name was Napok, which means hawk in your tongue. And he had the most incredible tale to tell. He had lived all his life on the other side of Middle Plenty, in a valley, and his wife and daughter had been driven out of his valley by the Alienorks, as he called the Alienorks, barely escaping, most of his extended clan and family being wiped out. This was a most alarming story. The Council of the Wise met at the Council Bluff by the sea to discuss the matter. Crazy in the head, insane? Was his presence here a danger to us? His tale was completely unbelievable. All of the tribes and clans of the Island of Plenty had learned to live in harmony many generations before. This was accepted and understood by everyone as the normal condition of all people, that the Alienork visitors to Far Plenty could be so dangerous and violently aggressive was simply implausible. Clearly, Napok must be insane. Perhaps climbing over all the steep ridges and down the even steeper cliffs for many weeks had driven him mad. It was decided that Napok and his wife and daughter could live with us in the middle valley of Near Plenty, but only if he stopped his bizarre public rantings about the Alienorks. Given that his speeches of warning to passers-by were extremely disturbing and they upset everybody, especially the children. This demand was put to Napok, and with some reluctance, he agreed to our conditions. No more crazy talk about the Alienorks or the Alienorks, as he spoke their name. His family was given the hut that belonged to an old widow before she died. It turned out that Napok was quite good at making useful items from bark and vines, and soon we all had very nice foot coverings that were especially useful for walking on shallow reefs and sharp rocks. Except for the occasional paranoid and conspiratorial whisper about the Alienorks, Napok was a fine addition to the people of Near Plenty. His wife was weak and frail, but his daughter, Nona, was pretty unpopular with our young men. Some of them were courting her, hoping to be paired with her when she came of age, which would make Napok and his family a full part of the people of Near Plenty. A few years after Napok joined us, another stranger, alone, climbed down the cliffs into the middle valley of Near Plenty. Old man with white hair and a white beard. But he was very fit and full of vigor for his age. His name was Amok, and he was the first person that I had ever met of the Alienorks, as I still called them until then. He said he was an elder and a teacher of the Alienork people, pronouncing their name just as Napok had pronounced it. Alienork was a very strange word to our ears and not easy for us to speak. It had no meaning in our tongue. Alienork only meant Alienork. The bearded elder corrected me until I spoke it to his satisfaction. Alienork. But to be said quickly, Amok didn't look so different from my people on the Island of Plenty, and he was rather pleasant and seemed as intelligent as any. He had certainly learned the tongue of the Island of Plenty very well. He told me the Eleonoric way was the way of peace, and that we would surely live together in harmony on the Island of Plenty. Amok asked if he could stay with us near our village, and in return, he could give lessons in the Eleonoric ways, in the Eleonoric tongue as well. Oh, he said it would be wise for us to learn these things. A volunteer teacher in the valley was always welcome. Anyone who wanted to learn about Far Plenty and other distant lands. At his request, we offered him a private hut. Amok was mostly quiet, didn't eat much, and caused no problems. But he did have a few peculiar requirements. First, he said that he needed a little more land for his hut because he was required by his beliefs to pray to the moon anytime it was up at night. And to do this correctly, he needed to make a little ring or circle of stones around his hut, and this ring needed more space than he had been offered. Also, he declared, it was the sacred custom of Eleonoric men to always wear a ceremonial dagger or sword at their belt as a symbol of their manhood. The dagger of Amok was thin and as long as my arm from elbow to fingertip. He kept it tucked beneath a red sash around his waist. Unlike my people, always wear the light wraparound pareo cloth, which also dries quickly, Amok wore a thicker robe of black cloth. He explained that the ring of stones and the sword and the moon singing and the black robes were all part of the Eleonoric way. And, as Amok reminded me, because of our first law of plenty, we had to allow him to believe as he chose, which was, of course, completely true. The Council of the Wise Men met, and we decided that if Amok would agree to always obey the two laws, we would also comply with his wishes concerning his private beliefs. He readily agreed to this, so we let him take a fallow field over past the other bluff. Our men even moved his hut over there for him. He then placed a circle of stones around his new dwelling, the circle being about 5 paces across from the side to the other side. And sure enough, after nightfall, and when the moon came out, he walked around the inside of his ring, and he prayed a strange song like a lamentation. Otherwise, Amok was a normal man in most every respect, very wise and learned and well-traveled, and a good speaker of our tongue. He quickly attracted a following of our younger men, who trailed behind him as he walked along the beaches and he spoke of his Eleonoric ways. And as well, he taught them the Eleonoric tongue. Now, prior visitor and longtime guest, Napok, was very upset by the introduction of the alien Nork Elder into our midst. And he came to me when I was alone at the lower fishing pool. He warned me not to trust Amok. He told me that everything that Amok said was a lie. It was very disturbing to me that Napok was acting crazy and paranoid again, considered whether I should notify the Council of the Wise about the degrading condition of his mind. But on the other side, I had to admit that at least Napok had been correct about the Ring of Stones and the Moon Singing and the Black Robe and the Sword. After a moon had passed one morning, when the village arose, we could see that there were now only one hut for Amok, and the Ring of Stones was now about 20 paces across. A few of us villagers walked over out of curiosity, and we saw that Amok was now joined by two young men and a boy, almost a man. Each of them wore a black robe, each with a sword longer than Amok's, in their red sash. I said to Amok, "Grandfather, who are these people?" "They are my nephews. They have escaped from Far Plenty, where there is currently much war and hunger. They need to have a new place to live in peace and safety. Do you see, Naku, that we have already erected more huts, so these newcomers will be no trouble at all?" And Amok reminded us that the second law of plenty demanded that we must extend our full bounty to those needy newcomers, and that they were very hungry after their long and difficult travels. We began to walk over to inspect the new huts to see how they were built, in the alien Nork method. But when our feet touched the Ring of Stones, the three new alien Nork men became filled with sudden anger and began to pick up other stones and throw them at us. It even seemed as if they were aiming at us, intending to cause us actual pain and harm. We all retreated back into the trees. Finally, Amok came out of the circle of stones. His arms extended in apology. "We must understand that it is part of the alien Nork way that we people of the Island of Plenty, whom Amok and the alien Norks called Norturks, should never, under any circumstance, ever enter inside the circle of stones without a direct invitation." He said this in a pleasant way, but he made it very clear to us, intruded within the sacred Alienork stone rings, uninvited. On the other hand, Amok's three nephews would walk freely through our village and our market, and even down by our pools for fishing and our pools for swimming. And when they walked among us, they spoke in their Alienork tongue in a very strange ways that suggested that they were insulting us and wiggled their extended tongues at our women and girls in a quite disgusting manner. Some of our near plenty men became angry and threatened the Alienork youths with violence if they did not stop their bad behavior. But the three drew their swords in a menacing manner at the approaching group of near plenty men, and both sides withdrew cautiously, the Alienorks throwing presumed curses and insults at our men in their tongue as they departed. The council met again, and I volunteered to speak to Amok about their bad behavior. I went to their circle of stones and called to him. and he came out to the ring. Opening his arms widely in welcome, he stated that I was bid to come inside as a special and valued guest and dear friend of considerable time now. We walked into his hut, and that was the first time that I saw that there were not only the three new male alien orcs, but also a hand of females, and that was only counting the females in Amok's tent. These new females had never been seen outside of any hut. And not only that, but each one of them was squatting on the ground, completely covered by a black blanket, extending to the ground. I only knew they were females by the low keening wails that they made as they rocked back and forth. Blame to Amok. What is the matter with your women? Are they sick with a disease? I recoiled in alarm. Amok gently took my arm and led me to them. No, he said, they are not sick. But it is the alien orc way that our women should stay inside our huts and must always be covered in a black blanket when Notark men are near. Just as Notarks must never cross the sacred circle of stones without any invitation, Notarks must never see the uncovered alien orc women. This is the alien orc way, he said. Amok reminded me of our first law about freedom of beliefs and said that these beliefs are all part of the alien orc way, and so they must be respected. To the crouching woman under their black blankets, I asked Amok, said I, Elder, what are the freedom of beliefs of these women? Do they too agree with the alien orc way? Amok crossed the small room, spoke sharply in the alien orc tongue, and nudged one of the women with his foot. All of the women in unison began to sing a strange high-pitched la-la-la-la-la song. La-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Until Amok nudged the nearest again, and they all stopped as one. You see, said Amok, this is how our women express that they are very happy. They prefer to live under their black blankets inside our huts, where they can feel safe from any harm. It is the alien orc way, and you must respect our beliefs. I know I agreed. It was our first law again. All beliefs are equal. I then said to Amok, your young men are causing great difficulties in the village, in the market, and at the pools. They are upsetting our women, and they are angering our men. A big fight almost happened today, and it could have led to the unimaginable, actual physical violence. Physical violence, which is the demon's burning hell compared to the heaven of the Island of Plenty. Physical violence, which is the opposite and the antithesis, sacred laws of plenty. Amok agreed with me that it was a most lamentable situation. But it was the alien orc way, that if alien orc men are around any women who are not covered by a black blanket, then the alien orc men may make such use of the women as they should so desire at that moment. This is a very important part of the alien orc way, declared Amok with finality. If the Notark women and girls do not wish to expel healthy and strong young alien orc men, who are acting only according to nature, that they must indicate this feeling by wearing the black blanket and by staying inside one of the huts of their men. I said to Amok that this is certain to cause a lot of problems, and that I am only a spokesman, and that the Council of the Wise will never agree to this. We decided to meet again after the next meeting of the council. Amok escorted me to the Circle of Rings and wished me well. The council met several times more, but no decision could be made. Napok also sought me out and warned me in the strongest terms not to make any agreement with Amok, but to drive the alien orcs out of the middle valley of Near Plentu while we still could. He said that alien orcs always lie, and that the alien orc way is not peaceful, but the path of war and violence and slavery and death and conquest. Beginning to suspect that Napok had been more right than wrong about the alien orcs back when he first came to live with us with his wife and daughter. Indeed, our situation had changed much for the worse since the appearance of Amok. In that time, before the final decision of the council, and on the first morning after the new sliver moon makes its brief appearance at nightfall, I went over to meet Amok to ask a point of clarification for another member of the council. I also wanted to ask him if he was indeed telling me the truth when he had told me that the alien orc way means peace. He met me at the edge of the circle of stones, but he did not invite me across it. I was astounded to see that the circle had been enlarged to at least 100 paces across, and there were now more than two hands of huts, and many more men and older boys, all of them with swords in their sashes. Not only that, but I recognized two young Noturk men among them, men who were now wearing the black robes, the red sashes, and the sharp metal swords of the alien orcs. A crowd of these young men sauntered up behind Amok, and began saying words in the alien orc tongue that made me feel very much afraid for my safety. Some half pulled their swords from their sashes, and others made the gesture of slitting their throats with a drawn finger, then pointing their finger at me. One of the boys cried out, "Notork, monkey dung." These were the first words in our tongue that I had heard spoken by any of the alien orcs except for their elder, Amok. Obviously, Amok, or one of the Noturk men, now dressed in the alien orc manner, had taught them the insulting words. The other boys took up the chant, "Noturk, monkey dung, Noturk, monkey dung, Noturk, monkey dung." I was in a state of bewilderment and turmoil that now, because there were many more alien orcs who had escaped from the wars and hunger in Far Plenty, they had need of many more huts, and their circle of stones now extended even into our village. And inside their sacred circle of stones, our own villagers must vacate their huts or take them off. But either way, there must not be even one single Noturk living within the circle of stones before the sun went down. I said, "Uncle Elder, how can this be? You yourself said that the alien orc way is the way of peace." Amok said to me that if we obeyed the alien orc way, we would be able to live in peace. I said that our people did not want to live in the Eleanork way, that our people preferred to wear the cool and convenient wraparound perioral, which dried quickly, and our women did not want to wear the black blankets and stay inside their huts. He said, then we will not have peace. The Northorks comply with the Eleanork way. Can there be peace? We Northorks must live accordingly to the Eleanork way. There is no choice in the matter. That is what Amok said. Then I was burning with angry rage. But the newly arrived Eleanork men behind Amok were half drawing their swords, so I had to keep a calm face. From behind them, the boys began to pelt me with pebbles and small stones, and they all chanted, Notork, monkey dung, at me. But I did not run away. Instead, I walked as normally as I could back to our village, pebbles striking my back and even my head, while inside my heart was filled with terror. Indeed, as Amok stated, their circle of stones now included the alien side of our snaking its way around a hand of our hut. Napok came to see me urgently. He said that I must assemble all of our men and somehow produce or create or invent new weapons. We had no metal for swords, only sharpened bamboo stakes. And these could be made quickly enough, but he said that we should nonetheless make them and prepare to violently battle the Eleanork, no matter the cost. What a shocking thing to say. Napok was clearly losing his mind again. Due to the sudden stress of dealing with increasing numbers of our new Eleanork visitors, I immediately took the issue to the Council of the Wise. After much discussion, it was decided Eleanorks could retain the newly enlarged circle for their own territory. That they must not enlarge it again, not by even one more pace ever. And I was to encourage the Eleanork men, by the way of Amok, not to harass our women anymore. And in return, our women would wear a doubled perioral, high to the neck and down to their knees. Our women very strongly did not want to stay in their huts under the black blankets. The Council of the Wise decided that we would meet the Eleanork way in the middle and make a compromise, and that we would not sharpen any bamboo spears, because if the Eleanorks found out this provocation, after nightfall, all of the Eleanork men did their wildest moon dancing yet, twirling and whirling and howling like demons. This lasted most of the night, until the moon fell near morning. Some of the villagers nearest the circle of stones, who had gone over to watch, reported that the Eleanorks threw large rocks at them and indicated that Notarks must never witness the moon dance, but rather that we Notarks must stay inside our huts during their moon dancing times. Eleanorque. The witnesses of their moon dance were told this in our own tongue by our own Island of Plenty men, the ones who had followed Amok and who had joined the Eleanorks. Of course, under the first law, this was their belief and their choice and had to be respected. The next morning, we arose in the village at the normal time. Even if our sleep had been disturbed during most of the night by the wild dancing and hallowing of the alien Nork men and the shrill la 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 lulling of the alien Nork women. But after dawn, when the normal morning noises of village life began, we all at once heard angry alien Nork shouting, and rocks began raining down on our village. Our many visitors cried out that we must not disturb the sacred sleep of the alien Norks after their long night spent performing their sacred moon rituals. It was the alien Nork way, and under the first law, we had to respect their beliefs. And under the second law, we had to extend them full bounty. And since they now had many new alien Orcs among them, who had fled the wars and hunger in far plenty, we needed to bring double the amount of fruit and vegetables and fish that we could bring. And while the boys chanted out, "Notork, monkey dung," the older man shouted that we must continue to obey our two laws of belief and bounty. Nothing further to be said on the matter. I made my way nearly to the edge of their ring, where it was close to some trees, calling out, "Amok, tell them to please stop throwing the rocks. This is not right. We are so sorry for waking you up. This is a misunderstanding." In a moment, the rocks ceased raining down. While I was there, Napok accosted me from a bit further back into the trees, beseeching me, begging me, to assemble the men, sharpen many bamboo spears, and prepare to fall no matter what the cost. To the reassembled council of the wise I went. We met very quietly, whispering and tiptoeing from hut to hut and over to the bluff by the sea. The extra fruit and vegetables would be no problem, but double the fish would be more difficult to acquire in a short time. It was decided that just in case, in secret, be set to making and hiding spears from sharpened bamboo poles, as Napok had been suggesting. As the sun went down, we all feared the events of the coming night with increasing dread and terror. The wild moon howling of the alien Nork men and the la 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 lulling of their women set our hearts to thumping. Napok came to my hut, terrified at the same time. He said that it had been reported that his daughter Nona had been taken and carried off, screaming, by two hands of alien Nork men, was simply walking from the upper pool to the market. He said that we must prepare to attack the sleeping alien Orcs the next morning and soon after dawn. We could slip up inside their ring of stones and kill many of them with our spears even while they slept. Then we could seize their sword and have a hope to win the battle and wipe them all out. And then he could find his daughter and bring her home. I told Napok that I would meet the council very early the next morning. But a dawn attack was impossible. It was not a decision I could take on my own part. I said that I was very sorry about his missing daughter, but nothing could be done about finding her, not while the alien Norks were in their wild moon dance frenzy. When the moon finally set, the alien Norks fell silent. The next morning when I awoke, rising very quietly as to the alien earth demanded, I went outside to the center of the village to draw a gourd of water, and I almost fainted. The headless and naked body of Napok, ceremonial platform, legs out. His bloody head was placed on the ground between his bare legs facing me. When the people of the village, and soon all the people of Near Plenty, heard of this unbelievable atrocity and saw the body of Napok, which we quickly covered, the council met at the bluff of the entire gathered population. It was difficult to keep the discussion at a quiet level so as to not to awaken the now sleeping alien orcs. It was decided that when they awoke, I must go to Amok to discuss this atrocity and what it would mean for our two peoples. I was shaking in fear, waiting at the edge of their enlarged circles of stone for them to awaken at their normal hour in the late afternoon. But it was my duty. Amok saw me and came to the edge of the circle of stones. Standing on the inside across them from me, perhaps he saw fear in my face. But now he spoke in haughty disregard. He said to me, I don't think we will have any more problems because now we, Notarks, all understood the Alienork way. Our Notark women must wear the black blankets and stay in their huts, and our Notark men must stop and bend low and look down at the earth when an Alienork man passes by. A Notark must never strike an Alienork, even if an Alienork man or group of Alienork men are enjoying an hour or two of pleasure with a Notark girl or boy or woman. And if any Notark man ever strikes any Alienork, for any reason at all, a hand, a Notark girl, will be taken and a hand of Notark men will be beheaded in the manner of Napok. And there must be no more talk of sharpened spears, as a spy from within the very council had already reported to Amok before Napok had been killed. I was shaking in fear and disbelief. But still I asked him, been lying to me when he first came into our valley, and told me that the Alienork way is the way of peace. He said it was not a lie, because a lie only had a meaning between Alienork men. To lie to Notarks about the Alienork way was also part of the Alienork way, and thus it was not a lie at all, but an even greater form of truth. I suddenly remembered pretty Nona, the daughter of Napok. Amok said that she had joined the Alienorks, and therefore I was not allowed to see her or speak to her ever again. The men and boys did not awaken this time with Amok to draw their swords or throw pebbles at me or curse me as a Notark monkey dung. Amok said that it was a very good thing that we Notarks had finally learned the Alienork way, and that he was finally hopeful that our two peoples could now live side by side in peace. He also mentioned that we needed to provide them with much more food to keep up with their growing numbers, especially fish, in accordance with our second law of bounty, which would be retained in full effect. Instead of gathering the council to report Amok's new demands, I took my wife and my two small sons to the beach behind the higher rocky point, where we kept our village sailing canoes because they were protected there from the waves that we used for fishing on the deep waters and also for going out to meet the occasional even larger boats visiting near plenty from far away. Gourds of water and baskets of food, and we set out downwind. After sailing two hands of day, we came to this island, your island, Happy Island, as you so truthfully call it. And as you have seen, my two sons were in a condition near death when we arrived, and my wife has not spoken a word for a hand of days even before we landed. I am happy that our tongues are not so different, and also that you are very kind and generous people here. And now I am asking your people, your Council of the Wise, your Assembly of Elders of Happy Island, if my family can please stay here to live in peace while my sons grow stronger and my wife returns her mind. When my sons grow to be young men, I will teach them to be warriors, and someday we will go together back to the Island of Plenty to fight against the invading alien orcs, if that becomes possible. But in the meantime, I am also before you to warn you in the direst terms that you must not, under any circumstances, never a single alien orc to place his feet upon your beautiful Happy Island. For if even one single alien orc comes to your island as a visitor and is allowed to have a hut within a circle of stones and to dance and howl to the moon and to carry a sword about him on a sash, with each passing moon, there will be many more alien orcs upon your island, and they will badly mistreat your woman and your girls, and they will force you to submit to the alien orc way and serve them, even though you are not alien orcs like them. Thank you for your consideration. I will retire to the hut you have kindly provided to my family and await your decision. The next day, the decision was announced by the Assembly of Elders after much discussion and reflection. The visitor, Neku, had stated that he had come from a place called the Island of Plenty, and he had then proceeded to spin a most bizarre, terrifying, and even disgusting tale about a group of people called the Alien Orcs, whom he said behaved more like demons from hell than like any of the people who inhabited Happy Island. All of the members of the Assembly of Elders agreed unanimously that the Alien Orcs could not possibly exist except as a twisted and damaged part of the visitor of Naku's mind, probably due to the privations of the long and difficult sea voyage he had endured to reach Happy Island. Therefore, it was decided that Naku could remain in our village, but only if he obeyed the one law of Happy Island, that only happy thoughts and ideas may be expressed in public. He must refrain from blurting his darkly provocative and frankly insane imaginings among our good people, lest he upset the successful formulation for maintaining social peace that had been learned over many generations, ever since the last wars amongst our distant ancestors. Turned out that Naku knew a very useful way to make foot coverings from bark and vines, much better for walking on the sharp rocky shores than our old coverings of dried sea kelp. He soon became a very useful member of our Happy Island Society, except for a few dark asides randomly whispered about his imagined demons, the alien orcs. His frail wife passed away, running and swimming with the other youth of our valley, popular among the boys and the girls alike. And everybody was glad for the better foot coverings that Naku taught us to make for ourselves. Otherwise, life went on as it always had. Until, that is, the day that a small sailing canoe came into view with a single man steering it. He was an older man with white hair and a white beard. It became apparent, as his boat drew closer, his sail had been spotted near the horizon. So the assembly of elders was able to go down to the beach to greet him, even before his canoe touched the sand. The old man on the boat did not look much different than the gathered elders of Happy Island, except for his white hair and beard, and the unusual black robe that he wore. As he stepped ashore from his beached canoe, he was smiling, his arms and hands open in a symbol of peace that invited a warm welcome. But then, suddenly from behind, I was roughly shoved aside, knocking me to the sand as Naku, our off-island guest of many years, dashed at full running speed towards the old man while screaming, "Amok! Amok! Amok!" And as we all watched in complete horror, Naku plunged a sharpened bamboo spear straight into the heart of the visitor, driving him back over into his sailing canoe. Naku, still in a mad frenzy, screaming about Amok and the alien orcs, pushed the canoe back through the small waves, turning it around, jumped aboard and filled the sail, trimming it flat and sailing around the second rocky point and out of our view. We were in such a state of shock that almost none of us dared to speak of the matter. There was not a single happy way to describe the terrible incident, so we did not, in accordance with our one law of Happy Island. Who returned to our village afoot, and he was soon pulled and pushed by several of our strongest men before the quickly gathered assembly of elders. Naku freely admitted that he had killed the old man, and that he was glad that he had done it, and that he would do it again if another alien orc ever on our shores. He said that only by his swift action had he saved us from a great disaster, a true calamity for the good people of Happy Island, and he begged us to believe that every single word that he had ever spoken of the alien Nork was true. He was even so bold as to suggest that we should actually reward him for his unprovoked and insane brutal murder of a single harmless elderly visitor. Our worst punishment was banishment from our valley on Happy Island. The assembly of elders decided that Naku to the next valley and then go quickly on to the next and the next after, and that he should not tell any people that he had met along the way anything about his paranoid and dangerous so-called alien orc way. Conspiracy theories, which after all, only existed in his severely damaged mind. And that was written by Matt Brackman in January of 2016. We are in dangerous times. We did not learn from Naku. We did not learn from NAPOC regarding the threat of Amok.
Thank you for listening. I'm going to sign off tonight. And if you want to hear news, I'm going to do a spot on YouTube tomorrow. But I want to say thank you and God bless.
American girls and American guys, we'll always stand up and salute. We'll always recognize when we see your glory flying. There's a lot of men dead, so we can sleep in peace at night when we lay down our heads. My daddy served in the army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard till the day that he died. He wanted my mother, my brother, my sister and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free. Now this nation that I love is falling under attack. A mighty sucker punch came flying in from somewhere in the back. Soon as we could see clearly through our big black eye, man, we lit up your world like the 4th of July. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And an eagle will fly, and it's gonna be here. When you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell, and it'll feel like the whole sorry that you mess with the U.S. of A. Cause we'll put a boot in your ass, it's the American way. Hey, Uncle Sam, put your name at the top of his list. And the Statue of Liberty started shaking her fist. And the eagle will fly, and it's gonna be hell when you hear Mother Freedom start ringing her bell. And it'll feel like the whole wide world is raining down on you. All brought to you courtesy of the red, white, and blue.